Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Not So Common podcast. I am Pat Contry, and my guest this time out is the esteemed retro game collector slash historian, Chris Kohler. He's been working at Wired in the past as a contributing editor, and he started the Game Life section, and he's now currently the Kotaku features editor. Chris, what's going on?
Pat, hello. Thanks for having me.
You know, Chris, we have a strange relationship. Just because...
Is it? How strange is it?
Because we don't see each other too much,
yeah.
Maybe twice a year at most.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a decent amount in common when it comes to wanting to work to preserve video game history. We're both big-time collectors. We both look at market trends. We don't always agree on a lot of the mm-hmm. issues, but at least we're in the same realm. We're in the same space, and we both sort of honor the same sort of retro gaming sensibilities, so to speak.
Yeah.
When you
we're like 95% similar, and then but we spend all our time arguing about the other 5%, you know, as these things go.
It's like politics in general. Like, usually people agree on 89%, but then the 10% divides us. No.
Right.
So I never, with that said, I don't know a huge amount about you. I was realizing that preparing for this conversation.
Okay.
It's like I don't know a hell of a lot about Chris Kohler. But
okay.
But I've known you on and off for, like, at this point, 5 years or so.
Yeah.
I've seen you at many Portland Retro Gaming Expos. We've done panels together, Retro Game Roadshows. I'm sort of like the Avengers affiliate. When you don't have anyone else to come on the panel, yeah, we kind of like Pat enough that he won't screw things up too bad. Come on up. We need you. You know, PAX East, we've been seen together at. By the way, I'm going to go back to PAX East in a month. But I don't know, like, how you got into retro gaming. Maybe you want to go over that.
Sure. Okay. Well, Miyamoto-san was born in 1955. How far are we going back?
Well, how did you rediscover, I guess, retro games? Unless you never really fell out of the original system.
I never got out of it. It was, we got our NES in 1988, and I mean, we got our Super Nintendo when I still had the NES hooked up with all the games. We never went through that purge where we sold all the games. You know, I think I would trade in some things here and there to get money to buy more games if I didn't want the game anymore. But it was never anything like where it's, oh, I regret I sold all my Super Nintendo games. So that was always something that was with me. You know, so where a lot of people, it's like, oh, I discovered, you know, emulators and Nesticle in 1998 and things like that. It's like, for that, it was like, oh, great, another avenue through which I can play games. But it's like I had never stopped playing Mario 3 and didn't, like, find it again or anything like that. So I just kept playing, kept collecting everything. I would go out. My parents were yard sale people. We're constantly going out to yard sales in the pre-eBay days, trying to buy stuff and, you know, going back to, you know, flea markets and selling it. And so I was there. We were always picking up lots of video games, things like that. I was amassing a collection of stuff and selling the doubles, you know, since I was a kid, since early 90s. So it was just never something that I had to pick up again.
So you've been a dirty reseller for 25 years. Wow.
That's absolutely. That's right.
It's interesting.
And
it's interesting that you have a similar background to a big collector, John Hancock, where his mother used to take him to flea markets quite often as well. He explained to me, and that's sort of so the passion or love for the video games never really died because you constantly saw it. Constantly were out there and rediscovering it or seeing it there. There wasn't like for me, there was this like 7 year gap in between consoles, like Super Nintendo and then late 90s getting back into it.
Right. And we didn't have, it's like when I was a kid, we had before we got an NES, my dad had a 2600. Mm-hmm. And I remember that's like my first gaming memory was like playing my dad's 2600, which he had set up at his workplace. You know, I was probably like 3 or 4. Like I remember Superman on the 2600. But then it's not like we had an Intellivision or a ColecoVision or anything like that, but we bought them. You know, after the NES came out, I started buying more old game systems at the time and getting into what was retro then in like the late 80s, early 90s. I'd be like, oh yeah, I got a ColecoVision. I got this Smurf game, whatever, that kind of stuff. And that sort of the early like, oh, if you get to Smurfette and then you walk backwards off the screen, she takes her clothes off, that kind of thing. Like that was, you know, we would talk about retro games in that sense. this weird old Smurf game you could play.
Is that true? I have to go back and play that. I forgot.
It's true, but it's not true. If you get to Smurfette in the Smurf game for the ColecoVision, then you walk back to the left, her sprite glitches out and it gets overwritten with something, and it just looks like she pulled her dress off, but that's not actually that wasn't like an Easter egg.
When you're 6 years old, that's the biggest thing ever. I remember in the late 80s, maybe like 89, 88, my neighbor had a 2600 and about probably 40 to 50 games. And we played Sega Genesis all the time. We played like NHL, you know, PA, and we played, so that'd be early 90s actually. We played Altered Beast and I think Sonic, but he had a 2600. And I remember when we played that, I was drawn to it at the time. So much so that I remember at maybe 10 years old making an offer for the 2600 and the games. And I remember the mom refusing because the mom's like, oh, no, this is worth money or something, or thinking that they were still remembering how much money they spent on those 40 games in the early 80s. They probably weren't all bargain bin clearance games. They spent probably $30 on Centipede back then. But I remember being fascinated with some of those games. So that was my sort of first sort of itch for retro gaming. Was something that came slightly before my time that was interesting to me because it was historic in a way. But I didn't get it. So that sort of fell through, which is a shame because I loved playing Keystone Capers at the time. But I guess that's sort of how it starts, where for some reason you're like, oh, I like this sort of, to me, primitive game, and there's something cheeky about it or something cute that it's not modern.
Right, right. And so even already then, you know, as we got into the early 90s, you know, I started doing, so the first thing I started doing with writing was I started making a fanzine because you know, I was reading Electronic Gaming Monthly, but also video games and computer entertainment, and Arnie Katz and Bill Kunkel and Joyce Worley, you know, talked a lot about how they came up, you know, these guys were the founders of video game journalism and the original magazine Electronic Games, but they had come up out of science fiction fandom. They had come up out of making fanzines for about science fiction back in the 50s and the 60s. And they were like, oh, people should do this with video games. And so Joe Santulli, the guys who now run the National Video Game Museum, they had a fanzine. It was called Digital Press. I had a fanzine. It was called Video Zone. And I was 13. And I was, like, making this thing and Xeroxing it. And where was I going with this? Well, that was some of the first, like, you know, writing that I was doing about games.
So what year was this about when you were 13?
So 1993, I was 13.
Okay.
I was born in 1980, so it's very easy to calculate the years. So 93, I put out this fanzine, and then I start trading fanzines with Joe at Digital Press. And at that time, you know, Digital Press was already doing its collector's guide, to video games, the very early versions of that, where they were just trying to catalog. They didn't even have prices in there. They were literally just trying to catalog all the Atari games. And so, of course, I get bit by a little bit of that bug seeing that. I mean, I'd always collected stuff. I collected Mad magazines and then got out of it. I collected rocks and then coins and then kind of got out of it. And then kind of ended up like settling on collecting video games because it was like sort of merging the passions.
Wow, that's so weird. I remember having a couple of the Digital Press when they were like just Xerox stapled together and mailed out.
Yeah,
I want to say I had that in like 97 or 98. I have a couple. Oh, wow, I hope I didn't throw them out. So you loved writing. You loved collecting. But you also had sort of this side where you wanted to document these things at the same time. So like sort of the three merging together. So who did you distribute VideoZone to? Like were you just like handing out to friends, or did you have a mailing list?
So the way that it worked was if you sent your fanzines in to Arnie Katz at Electronic Games Magazine or Video Games Computer Entertainment, he would review your fanzine and print your address and say, this is where you can write to get an issue of this fanzine that I do this little capsule review about. So basically, I just ended up, I mean, some people would like send me $1 if my fanzine got reviewed and I'd send them a copy of it, but mostly it was trading with other people that did fanzines. And so they were my mailing list, and then I got theirs as well. And that's how it was, this pre-internet community of video game fans doing this sort of like you know, raw, you know, unpolished, unprofessional, but also not really tainted by like advertising, you know what I mean? The sort of like the predecessor to NeoGAF, except for we wrote it all down and Xeroxed it and sent it to each other.
So you were just reviewing whatever you can get your hands on at the time, writing about
anything
trends.
I can get my hands on at the time. That's right. Yep.
So were you big into the rental shops? I'm guessing you can just easily try some stuff without spending $50 on it.
Definitely. I mean, you can kind of see me becoming more of a like RPG nerd as you sort of read through the magazines, because I start getting into Secret of Mana and then Final Fantasy and then trying to get all the RPGs I could on the Super Nintendo, and that starts becoming more of it. And then that all kind of faded out once I basically went to college. I think I did an issue or two in college, but I just had too much going on. Plus, at that point, I was starting to get work. I mean, I was actually off the back of Video Zone, which I would then send to magazines. Eventually, my writing got to the point where they were like, well, we'll pay you whatever, $100 to review a video game. So, of course, I'm in college, and that's like, that's great money. So I started doing that.
So you made contacts early, you got experience mm-hmm. early. So by the time you got to college, you're like, all right, I'm already in this world. You're already
that's right.
Leg up on everyone else who wants to get into it.
Yeah, by college, I had a couple of regular freelance gigs, and I was making, I mean, again, it was like, you know, if you totaled it all up, I would make like $3,000 in a year, you know what I mean? But you'd get, I mean,
but
you
paid.
Got free video games. Like, I mean, that was, you know, they'd send you a review copy of the game, and at that point, it wasn't a code, and it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't a CDR or anything like that. I mean, it would just send out, you know, full versions of the game, so that was really important as well. You know, I mean, for a lot of freelancers starting out, the fact that you weren't paying for your games was, you know, I mean, that was part of it.
But you're a professional, and this to be a professional writer is a big deal.
That's right.
And especially you're in the genre you want to be in. So
so
then you get to Wired.
Yes. No, a little bit happened between those two things.
Okay.
one is that I had been to Japan. I did my whole junior year of university in Japan. And then as I was prepping to graduate from school, I applied for a Fulbright scholarship. And basically I said, this is my plan for the Fulbright scholarship, by the way, is the United States works with the governments of other countries to bring scholars. It can be graduating seniors, as it was in my case. It could be graduate students. It could be professors, you know, a lot of experience. But to bring people from one country to the other, pay for them to go, for them to do a research project. And so what I pitched was, I want you to send me to Japan, and I want to write a book about Japanese video games. There was no book. This is 2004. There was no book at this point that was like about, specifically about Japanese video games and Japan, and why are Japanese video games so, you know, why were they so popular worldwide? What actually happened there? Why was it Japan that was able to create these games that were so popular worldwide? So that was the pitch. I got the Fulbright scholarship. So I spent a year in Kyoto studying Japanese games, doing tons of interviews, and put together my first book, Power Up. And so that was out in 2004. And by the time that came out, I had done a little bit of freelancing for Wired. But after that, I moved to San Francisco and then started just picking up even more freelance. And then Wired became my main gig. And so that's kind of how that happened.
So what was it like being in Japan then for, you said, a year, and you were just pounding the pavement, trying to contact video game companies, interview what are now luminaries of the field. And you were just sort of working through that?
Yeah, I mean, luckily I already had some like public relations contacts with like Nintendo and with some other people, so I was able to talk to Miyamoto while I was there, and so that formed a major part of the book. I tried to talk to everybody I could, but it was tough banging down those doors when I was a freelance writer. It was kind of unproven, you know. I thought the book was going to be good, but you know, it was hard to convince people. So the doors that I was able to bust down, you know, those are the people that are in the book, and fortunately, I mean, I was able to get some good interviews. I spoke with Masaya Matsura, who did Parappa the Rapper. I spoke with Yuji Horii, who did Dragon Quest. Dylan Cuthbert, who was on Star Fox. I got to talk to Eiji Aonuma, the producer of the Zelda series. Fumito Ueda, who had just come off of ECO. And he had not done Shadow of the Colossus. That had never been revealed. You know, certainly it was very far away from The Last Guardian. So we did a whole interview about ECO. It was probably at that point the most extensive interview that guy had done, because this was still early in the process. And so I did. I was able to talk to a whole lot of people and put together what I think was it was tough because I was in my early 20s and I didn't know anything. You know what I mean? To look back now, I'm almost 40 and I'm just like, wow, you're a real idiot. But, you know, at the time, it was the best that I could do to try to put together a survey of like, this is what Japanese video games are like.
And you also then had to learn about the culture and you got to get used to that.
Yeah.
Besides, I guess we can talk about that, but also discovering, I guess, the Japanese world of retro video games and the shops.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, so yes. So I went to originally I was living in a city called Kanazawa in Japan. It's like the seventh at the time it was like the seventh biggest city in Japan. It's out on the West Coast. But I'll tell you, you kind of learn that in Japan, most of the old video games are in Tokyo, like 80% of them are in Tokyo, 15% of them are in Osaka, and then the other 5% are like just scattered all across the country. And so living in Kanazawa, I would just hit up, I found all the places I could find old games at, and I would just routinely hit those up. And I didn't find very much. I found a lot of stuff eventually after a year of searching, but like it was like, it was tough to find things. I think I saw there was one PC Engine that I ever saw in the entire city at all, and I bought it.
Just one.
So, just one. There was literally one in 1 year. Like, one shop had one PC Engine, and I bought it. But then, like, you go to Akihabara, which I did. I took a couple of trips out there and stayed with a friend. And you go there, and literally, there's just stacks and piles of them, right? And so that going to Akihabara for the first time in 2000 was amazing because it was still a retro game, an absolute like retro game paradise. It would still take you all day. There were like 20, 25 different stores you'd have to hit up to see everything. Now it's like you can go to like 5 or 6 stores and see everything. And it's mostly like anime and maid. I mean, it was anime, maid cafes, like all that stuff. Now was not Akihabara in 2000. Akihabara in the year 2000 was like just electronic stores, appliance stores, video game stores, like that kind of stuff.
Is that just because the culture changed? All the games are now in collectors' hands. There's just less stuff to sell.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, well, a lot of it, quite frankly, is yes. Yeah. So, first of all, at the time in 2000, I think Yahoo Auctions existed at that point. Yahoo Auctions is what Japan uses. They don't really use eBay as much. They use Yahoo Auctions for some weird reason. But the average person did not sell stuff online. The average person did not sell stuff by themselves. If you had to sell something, you took it to a used store and you sold it to them. Like, that's what happened. So all these stores had no problem just getting whatever inventory they wanted. Now people have realized they can sell stuff on their own. Now people have realized we can buy stuff at a cheap price from the thrift stores and sell it on eBay to foreigners mostly and send it out of Japan. So yeah, stuff is disappearing, and people have less of a reason to sell it back at 50% to the stores, whereas they can sell it for 100% and net 80-85% by just selling it themselves on Yahoo Auctions.
So a parallel to here, so
yeah,
to speak.
But additionally, Akihabara just became a happening place because what ended up happening, you know, kind of starting in the early 2000s and really being big now, is that Japan became super cool all over the world. And otaku culture, anime, manga, all of that kind of stuff went from being underground, and now it is like out in the open. And I think just the real estate in Akihabara now. Akihabara is now, there was a poll that I saw where Akihabara was more of a, like they asked tourists coming to Japan, what are the places in Japan that you want to go to? And Akihabara outranked Tokyo Disneyland.
Wow.
Like Akihabara was like number 7 on the list. And that just shows you, like, when I was there, people were like, Aki, what? Where are you going? You're going to buy video games? That's weird. You should go to temples. You should go to here. But now it's like everybody wants to go there. And so the real estate in Akihabara has got to be so expensive now that it's hard for, like, a video game store to set up shop and operate there.
Interesting. So you had subcultures and hobbies help redefine this area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. So what was there a culture shock when you first were in Japan? How quickly did you get used to the people and the customs when you went?
there was more of a culture shock coming back because you go somewhere. I mean, you know, certainly you discover things. You discover that you go through the honeymoon period of this is the most amazing thing ever, and then you go into the trough of thinking this is the worst, why did I come here? And then, you know, hopefully it kind of normalizes. Coming back was tough because you get back to America and it's like, oh my God, it's so dirty here. Why is everything so dirty? Japan is just such a clean place, and not only because they clean it, but because there is this generalized sense among everybody that we should all work together to keep all of this stuff really clean and not litter and not, you know, poop in the escalator, as is often the case here in San Francisco, where I live.
Wow.
Not that I personally have done that very much, but that it happens a lot.
Well, I don't want to see that go through the grate and come back around. That'd be kind
no, you do not.
Kind of messy. Oh my God.
That was what happened. No, I mean, there was literally the BART, which is the commuter train here in the Bay Area, announced that, like, you know, this elevator is or this escalator is shut down because it's too full of human feces and we have to clean it.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Well,
so the culture shock, as I said, was coming back.
Coming back. Because it's like, oh, I want to live here. And I know you go back every so often. I see you tweeting that you go back. So you just like to visit every once in a while?
Yeah, that's correct. I, if my life had taken a different path, maybe I would end up living there. I mean, some people I know certainly ended up living there. For me, it was like, you know, maybe I don't actually want to live here after all. You know, you entertain that notion. But then it's like, maybe I want to live in America. Maybe I want to visit Japan.
I was going to say, I mean, you live in one of the most expensive cities in the U.S., if not the most. I mean, Tokyo can't be that much worse, or parts of Japan.
Yeah, that was not my intention. I did not choose. I came here before all the other everybody. The dot-com bubble had burst, and everything was, housing prices were very low.
Oh, so you got in before, you got in the bottom floor there. You didn't have to worry
about
it. I
did, but then I had to move out of my, like, awesome, like, $1,000 a month, you know, rent-controlled apartment, and we move into something else. We own now, so we're all set, though.
They had to gentrify the area that you were in. So you're in San Francisco now. So, okay, we'll get to – so eventually you get to Wired, right? So,
sure.
You have this experience. You're a young published author.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With Power Up, which is great. So did the book do well when you first released it?
Nope, not at all. It was published by Brady Games, which was the strategy guide publisher, and they thought they wanted to get into nonfiction. I think they looked at what Prima had done with Stephen Kent's book, The Ultimate History of Video Games. They looked at some other stuff, and they said, okay, nonfiction about games, we should get into that. So I'm very grateful that they took a chance on my book and they published it, but they didn't get it into bookstores. They got it into EB Games and GameStop and stuff like that, and you couldn't find it in bookstores. And again, this is 2004, so it's not like, you know, the Amazon is not happening. You really need that bookstore distribution. And what ended up happening is they put it in there in like September, at the end of the holiday season. The GameStops, whatever of the world, had all these copies left, which they pennied out. They marked them all at a penny.
Ugh.
And then they threw them in the trash, and then that was it. That was the distribution of the original version of Power Up.
I don't think a 12-year-old looking at their Metal Gear Solid strategy guy is going to look over, oh, I'm going to do some heavy reading about...
absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're right. It's always... I always do find it funny when somebody's like, oh, yeah, I saw that at a GameStop, and I thought, oh, wow, that's so interesting, and I bought it. I'm like, oh, you're the one. You're the guy. That's great.
Chris,
but,
did you...
It's out now again. It's out now from Dover Publications with a new chapter, and so they're doing it a lot better.
Chris, you started your own nonfiction video game book crash.
Yep.
It was pennied out. Well, it's
it
interesting because
yeah.
even in the mid-2000s, you can probably still count on one hand the number of games that dealt with video game history. There wasn't a huge amount
That's right.
out there.
Oh, I owned them all. I had read every book about video games. Like, there's, and there just weren't that many out there. And so at the time, you know, I felt there was an opportunity to write something new. And what's exciting now is there's tons of stuff about Japan and video games. So many amazing books out there to read that you can't even, you know, I certainly can't say anymore that I've read even a fraction of what's available out there, which is great.
Well, I guess the supply has caught up to the demand for that sort of material.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. I mean, yeah, there's a new video game book or retro gaming guide coming out every other month.
They're all exhaustive lists of NES games. Every single one of them.
Every single one
is a giant hardcover coffee table book that lists every game available for the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Is there just a whole league of them? That's its own section now. Is that what?
It is. It's its own genre at this point.
Oh, I'm glad I can help popularize that genre.
That's right.
So tell me about, you come to Wired,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, okay, we want you. You're okay. You have some experience.
Sure. Yeah.
And then you help start up a whole new section.
Yeah. So what ended up, okay. So at this time, this is when Kotaku was starting up. This is when Joystick was starting up, Destructoid, you know, probably some others that I'm forgetting. But everybody was starting what was essentially called at that point a blog. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of realizing that the web changed publishing. You should not be, you know, producing like, you know, 5 stories per day. You know, it should be a thing where it's just publishing is just sort of constantly happening. And so Wired was like, let's get into this. Let's do what Gawker was doing at the time and hire, you know, 10 people, each of whom is an expert in some field, and have them write, you know, a constantly running stream of stories of shorter, faster, you know, stuff about certain subject areas. And after they started that with, there was like a gadgets blog and a sex blog and one other thing. And then I went to the Wired office because they were having a party and I was doing some freelancing for them here and there. And I'm like, I'm going to make the play. Like, this is where I'm going to make this move. And I went to the party and, you know, after having a little bit of a conversation with the editor in chief, was like, so you should do a video games blog. I should write the video games blog for you. And he's like, oh yeah, we should do that. And so, that's basically how that got started.
So that allowed you to Wired even, what year was this when you started with them?
2005.
So even then,
so I had done a little bit of freelancing for them over the intervening 3 years. In 2005 is when we started Game Life.
So you figured this is a huge publication, but maybe they have to be more, go for the jugular when it comes to gaming news, and then gives you an opportunity then to insert even retro gaming and video game history topics every
Absolutely.
Now and then.
Absolutely. So I started doing that.
Start seeding the public.
Yeah, well, I was doing Here's What I Found at Thrift Stores as part of it. You know, every couple
that.
Of weeks I would do, yeah, so I would do the weekend thrifting and like, this is what I got at thrift stores today, this is what I found at the flea markets, and you know, at the time, it was super easy. This is like 2006, 2007. Like,
the salad days.
And I'm living, oh, so good. I was living in San Francisco, and it was just like, I mean, I tell this story a lot because it's true, and the point is that I would never do this again, but I would just wake up on a Saturday and just take the bus all around San Francisco, Hayton, Ashbury, you know, the Mission District, downtown, you know, Chinatown, Japantown, back to my house, every thrift store. And I'd come back with bags full of stuff, you know, consoles, multiple CDIs, bags upon bags of CIB games and TurboGrafx's and TurboGrafx games and whatever. I would never do that today. Like, that would be a total waste of a Saturday today to even do that, because it's all gone. But for a while, it was amazing.
So that was compiling the collection. I guess you also had spare time to trade or sell some of the extras you also compiled at the same time while you were working at Wired?
You know, at that point, I think that so at that point, if I found anything that I already had, I'd probably just throw it on eBay or something like that, because there wasn't really, you know, much of an outlet. And honestly, it's not like the stuff went for that much, because
no,
nothing really cost that much at that point.
Yeah. So
and I probably had a little box of doubles that, you know, that I was working on, but yeah.
It's so funny you say garbage bags, because yes, you sometimes find them. So the flea markets here were good. Sometimes they hit up 3 in one day when it was worth it.
Yep.
Here. They don't take a bus, thankfully, just a car. But yeah, sometimes there'd be garbage bags of games and stuff, and then I'm walking back with a backpack full. I have like those shopping bags, like the oversized one, 2 of them. My buddy Frank, we might know or have mm-hmm. heard of, he's carrying a bag for me. Sometimes it'd be so messed up that I would forget, like I say to someone selling something, even if it was toys or a box console, hey, can we pick this up later? Sure. I would forget where they were, because sometimes it was like one thing there. I'd have to rewalk the entire thing to find what right. I what
going
I
going up to people yeah. and be like, hey, did I buy something from you?
Yeah, it was that
hold it.
It was that insane. It was probably like that, at least around here, until about, I'd say, 2011. Once mm-hmm. you hit 2012 yep. to 13, then it started to be a much bigger influx of more collectors, and also people would start pricing things more because everyone had smartphones by then, for the most part. So it was a bad combination. But yeah, if I didn't go to the swap meet, I felt anxiety at the time, probably because I was also out of my mind, because I was like, oh my God, I'm missing out on all this stuff that people are basically giving away. So right, it was right, a, right. It was a sickness. It was an obsession mm-hmm. at the time that I had to get over slowly but surely, and working on that book that's one of a thousand checklist books, as you described, that was part of the reason. Was like, okay, I got to work on other things. I can't go. But there was a nice 3-year period where I went almost every Saturday and Sunday, 2 days a week, and was spending hundreds of dollars every weekend at the swap meet. And that's volume. That's just not a couple of things. That's like volume of stuff.
Right. And I still, so I kind of had to make a decision like, well, what is the smart thing for me to do? So I, mm-hmm. right now where I live, there's literally 2 thrift stores that are right outside my front door, like across the street.
That's why you bought there.
And like a block or a half a block away. So I'll go to those. I mean, that's not costing me anything. And I will absolutely find stuff there. But I would never like go out of my way, you know, to do it. Yeah. I'll pop in there as I'm like walking back home or something like that. But like I'll do that. But when I go to the flea market, I will get up at the, you know, butt crack of dawn and get to the flea market super, super early. I have gotten there when it is dark because that is when the stuff sells. Like yeah. you have to get it then. And it's there. Like, it will be. I mean, it depends on your flea market. My flea market, the stuff is there. So, I mean, you just got to get there really early and get it. But if you're getting, if you're going to that flea market and you're getting there at 10 a.m., it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to say, oh, there's nothing at my flea market. My flea market is dry. It's like, no, somebody bought it already.
Yeah, I used to get to mine at 7. That's when you're allowed in, unless if you're a seller, they're roaming around at 6 a.m. when it's literally
right,
dark
right.
out. But getting in at 7... some of the stuff is still there. It depends on the time period, but I guess they're lazier down in San Diego. I've had a friend that after I left would walk around and do a second go around, and people were still putting stuff out at 10 a.m. And he would find, you know, where's an example? Oh, just an Uncharted Waters on NES. He'd find that after I went through that cellar and it wasn't even out yet.
Right.
So
right.
there
mean,
is that does
can happen.
Too.
It's true. Yep. That's right. Yep.
Or I'd leave and he'd be like, oh yeah, you know, I happened to stumble upon a guy and, you know, he did have some rare stuff or find a Flintstones.
I'd say, yeah, I'd say either go early or go late, you know, yeah. either go super early or just go at the very, very end of the flea market, because it does actually give you a little bit more leeway in terms of bargaining. And yeah, like, especially if people are still pulling stuff off of the trucks. Flea market that I go to, there's nowhere for it to go. Like there's, yeah. It's a small flea market.
So you've been collecting then longer than I have. You've been collecting. You never stopped buying games, basically. So,
that's right. Yeah.
So you can say you've been collecting for 30 years at this point, as opposed
sure,
to me, where
not?
I can say it's been about 20, 21. So do you feel that collector itch at this point lessening? Is it still just as strong? Is it being refocused towards preservation and archiving versus collecting? Where do you see yourself now versus even 10 years ago?
Well, I still really enjoy collecting, but at this point, it's like when you used to be able to go out and buy tons of stuff for no money, it becomes very difficult to say, like, but when people spend $500 on a copy of Hagane, you know, a loose cartridge with a messed up label, and I'm like, what is the trade-off there? Like, I don't see the joy. I'd rather have the $500 than that copy of that game. You know,
sure.
It's really weird. Like, but at the same time, I did just spend like close to that on a copy of a game called The Death Trap, which was a Japanese PC game that I can't even play because I don't have literally an old Japanese like PC. But it was the first game ever released by Square. And it was the first game ever made by Hironobu Sakaguchi, who is the creator of Final Fantasy. And I actually just finished doing that collection, a collection of the PC games that Square made prior to getting into Famicom and NES. And I was like, see, the thing with these games is they're super rare. Some of the ones that I found over a year and a half of searching, it's like the one copy that came up on Yahoo Auctions. Because they're not on eBay. A lot of them aren't even in Akihabara when I go and look there. They just come up on Yahoo Auctions. And it's like, oh, this is the one copy that came up in a year and a half, 2 years of searching. Okay? They're rare, but not a lot of people care. So I like going after stuff where it's rare, it's interesting to me, but nobody else is really hardcore going after it, so the prices are not spiraling out of control.
Well, that's like a lot of PC gaming. I mean, PC gaming has gotten hotter the past couple of years, but
it has.
For a long time, no one but me and three other people gave a shit about it. Like, because for a lot of people, they didn't grow up with a lot of PC games versus console. But it's like, oh, who cares if you get the original Ultima? You know the Apple II version. Is that really a thing?
But it also gets all of the, all of the people that are buying and selling now, all the people that are sort of like quick flippers who are just like trying to buy console game collections and then sell them. You know, they're not into PC. Like, they'll pick it up if it's super cheap, but they also don't really care. So, I mean, I just won an auction on eBay for a, you know, giant stack of PC games. You know, half of it was like Sierra LucasArts stuff. It was really good. And it was an auction. Anybody could have bid on it. And I got it for a very low price, that I consider it to be a low price, because there's just not as many people playing in there, because the guys who are just going to buy, I mean, any lot of Super Nintendo games is going to go for like 80% of its value, because people will buy it and then mark it up to 120% and then sell it. But there's less baloney like that going on in PC games. So yeah, like, even though the prices of PC games are getting higher, they are getting hotter, there's just less of there's less action happening there, so it's, you can find better deals.
Well, I feel that PC collecting is very specific.
Yeah.
You're not going to have people go out and buy swaths of games that they either don't have experience with or don't know about, because there's just so much out there. It's impossible to get it all. There's a lot of garbage, and people don't collect like, oh, I'm an IBM XT collector. No, you're not. Maybe you collect Infocom games, or maybe you collect LucasArts games, you know, maybe you collect all of a certain subset of text adventure. So it's an entirely different beast than console games. So yeah, when you go to conventions, when you see someone selling old PC or IBM or Apple II games, it's like, I know I have to compete with two other people here probably. But I know that there's a game that I want, someone else wants that same exact game probably. Like, that's basically how it is. You're less likely to splinter off and both buy different sorts of games.
I think that conventions are a wonderful place to find more obscure stuff that you are into. Like, the convention is the worst place to try to buy, I don't know, Earthbound. You know what I mean? Because everybody at that convention, there's tons of people that are going for Earthbound. But if you're talking about, you know, Japanese stuff, big box PC stuff, you know, magazines, manuals, boxes, all the other kind of things, I think you have a better chance going to a convention. If somebody has weird stuff like that, you have a better chance of getting it and getting a deal on it, because there's just less competition.
And that's how I know I'm in the twilight of my quote-unquote collecting career. You might get there too eventually, Chris. You might be 85, but you'll get there. When I now, for the most part, look out for the weird stuff or the stuff that I know that only I would be interested in, or a handful of people. And I've completed my NES collection. I don't know if I told you that. So the North American.
Oh, congrats.
Sure. We can get into the feeling that I have about that. It's sort of like, yeah, it's finally done. It's like a chore at this point. It's like, I could have done it years and years back. And it's like, I kept putting off. And it's not like the final few games I got, they really didn't go up in value either the past year. They sort of stayed the same place. So it's just like, yeah, I got it over with. Like, I felt like I had to. But now it's looking at odd controllers for myself, odd peripherals. I'm always into odd NES peripherals, because honestly, every year I find still one or two peripherals I've never seen before. Regional ones, ones that are knockoffs of other ones. So it's very interesting. I don't know if there's a catalog, even a website anywhere that lists every single NES peripheral. I doubt it. I highly doubt it, because there's hundreds or close to a couple hundred.
Yeah.
But that's where I am now. And so if I really want to get something, it has to be very specific. And I'm not in the mode anymore where I'm just going to buy whatever I can to buy. It has to be something, a subset of something, an odd Super Nintendo game that won't cost me $200, but I think is interesting, like the Looney Tunes basketball game, for example. I remember picking that up a couple years ago. Yeah. Oh, this is weird. I never really heard of it. It's like $5, you know.
Right.
But in terms of like mass buying of stuff, that's done. I can finally say I've sort of hit a peak. Maybe I'm getting older. I have less energy. I don't go to the flea market as much as I used to. But maybe it's sort of a, I don't know, a sign of the times where collectors roll over and they become something else. They become more archivists or preservationists.
Yeah. So for me, it was kind of like, I mean, especially, you know, as our mutual friend Frank Cifaldi, you know, started really formalizing what he was doing, starting the Video Game History Foundation, I just decided, you know, this is very important to me. I want to make sure that I'm not the collector that goes out and buys stuff and puts it in a box and forgets about it and doesn't use it. So I've made it very clear to Frank, you know, if I have it, you know, and you need to use it for something, it's yours. If I were to find a prototype, we will dump it and make sure that people can enjoy it. I'm not hoarding it. I'm not keeping it for myself. If I have materials, archival materials, things like that, that you want to scan, you're please do it. And it's really nice, I think, for all of us that the Video Game History Foundation now exists, because it was really difficult to talk to people and say, oh, you're a game designer, you have all these unreleased games, and you have all of these, you know, design docs and archival materials, you should give them to my friend, Frank.
Just give it to him. Just mail it to him.
Right. And he would have done something wonderful with it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He doesn't care. He doesn't want the stuff. He doesn't care about the physical stuff. He wants to disseminate it, and he wants to archive it. But now that it's actually a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and people can donate to it and then write that donation off of their taxes, and it's a real thing, it's much easier to say, here's the information for the Video Game History Foundation. You guys should talk to them about making sure that this stuff is preserved.
And that's at gamehistory.org for everyone. And that's been around for now, what, a year and a half? Two years?
Yep.
A year and a half. It's interesting because you try to spread the word. I don't think some collectors don't care about it. I don't think they don't see the value as much as other people when it comes to that. I remember running into one seller. I won't call them that exactly because they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. They did have an NES earlier build prototype. I'm like, I saw them at a convention with it, and they weren't selling it, but I'm like, they were just showing off this game. I'm like, have you dumped that yet? So they're like, nah, we haven't done that yet. And I was like, well, you really should. I mean, you can buy the little whatever it's called, I forget, the Kazoo, whatever, for like 25 bucks, and you can do it yourself. Or I said, you can mail it to someone named Frank that I know. And then I saw them, and they said, okay, we'll look into that, whatever. And then I saw them like a year later, and they still had it, and they hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting that I'm not sure what you can do to convince people that, hey, you should do this just in case something bad happens to that game, or you lose it, or there's bit rot, or God forbid, you sell it to someone who will never intend on dumping it, keeping it locked away forever, like a certain NES prototype that a friend of ours saved. You know, like there's important reasons for this. This is, and I hate to say it, not to get into legality. It's like, well, you don't own that game. You don't have the right to lock it away when it comes down to it. If you really want me to get technical.
Well, like, I mean, I think they do have the right if they want to. It's about convincing some people that's the wrong way to go about it.
Well, no, they don't hold the intellectual property. So if I own a prototype to a game, I really don't. That's the company who developed it. They own it.
It depends. It depends on how it was acquired. Because if it was legally considered abandoned property, and if it was thrown away, you know, and you abandoned it, if it was legit given away to an employee, if it was auctioned off, I mean, a lot of people end up, but you know, back in the day, you know, a lot of the early collectors would go to the company would go bankrupt. They'd go to the auction of the assets and buy the assets, which included prototype games, and they don't own the intellectual property that's on there. But I own my copy of Super Mario Brothers. I own that cartridge, but I don't own the underlying rights to the computer code, but I own my copy. And if you have a prototype, then you own a copy. You don't own the underlying rights. It's like somebody found they found an Oswald the Lucky Rabbit short, you know, that was on the film strip reel. They sold that for a lot of money because they don't own the Oswald the Lucky Rabbit short, but they own that print of it. And Disney had to pay them whatever, five figures to get it back. Disney can't just say, we own that.
So you're saying from the first sale doctrine, you're like, okay, even if it's a prototype, that I can do whatever I want with it.
Yeah.
Sure. It's still ethically sucky. if you go that
route. No, I mean, well, yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, well, that's, yeah, so look, there's a lot of things that you have the right to do, but that people are going to approach you and say, you know, hey, you may have the right to do this, but, you know, it's what we think is the nice thing to do to people is to dump it and allow everybody to enjoy it.
What do you think about the current climate where people take unreleased games, they buy the rights to them or the prototype, and then they then end up publishing it, doing Kickstarters? Do you think that's an overall positive because the game gets out there? Is this something that I'm surprised I've seen it develop this quickly over the past few years? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I mean, yeah, again, if you want to spend the money to actually go ahead and acquire the intellectual property rights to something, sure. I mean, this happens with films. People buy the intellectual property rights to films and re-release them, whatever, on DVD. If you're going about it all the right way and you think that that's a business that you want to be in, great. I think that in the case of, so for example, the Socks the Cat prototype that people finished and put out, I think that for historical purposes, they should dump the original ROM, the original work that was done, and put that out there for people to experience, so that they could see what the actual, you know, the actual prototype played like and felt like, versus the version that they did where they, I mean, apparently the game is very buggy, so they fixed the bugs, made it playable all the way through, and then released that onto a cartridge. That's fine if you want to do that, but I mean, I think let's all remember here that we're trying to preserve history as well as if you guys want to make money. So it's just a nice thing to do at that point.
Oh, so that was a case of a prototype copy being found, but was, I'm not going to get into whether or not they actually purchased intellectual rights to do it, but they at least got the prototype. They copied it, they downloaded it, they altered it and put it out.
Okay. Sorry, let's say for purposes of argument that they have the rights and that it's all locked down.
I've heard things on that makes me, I'm not sure, I'm not going to get
sure.
into it.
So simply as a hypothetical here, let's say they had.
I'm not saying one way or the other.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm just saying, like, for, you know, arguendo, they have the rights, well, they should still release the original version. But
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, there's a guy who put out Super 3D Noah's Ark again on Super Nintendo. He bought the IP rights
Pico
from
Interactive.
Three.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're putting out the first, I think, the first N64 prototype that they found that they're releasing. They got the rights.
Oh, the 40 Winks. Right. Look, yeah. If you have the rights, you know, go ahead and do it. I mean, honestly, we're going to see that happen. We are just on the verge of, I think, classic cartridge, official classic cartridge reproductions. They're going to become big, I think. I mean, I think that this the success that IM8Bit had with their Street Fighter 2 cartridge, I think that they're going to start convincing more video game companies that this is a good idea. It's like, is it a lot of money for Capcom? You know, they make 5,000 of these, they sell them for $100 each. Is that a lot of money?
Well, they're just, for them, it's easy money if they're just licensing it out. Here,
that's
you deal
it.
With
exactly.
It. Yeah.
It's just one of many licensing deals that they do, and it's just more money that comes in. It's a matter of smaller companies like IM8Bit being really passionate about it and getting them to give them the rights. I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be.
I do.
I don't know if it's going to be like the resurgence of games on or resurgence of music on vinyl that's kind of been happening, but like I think that it's going to happen.
Yeah, we're seeing that. We're seeing other companies like Retrobit put out their collections of like Jalico games or Data East beat 'em ups, for example. And you have to look at, I think, the specific property. Who is it marketed towards? Obviously, something like the Street Fighter 2 30th anniversary was marketed to collectors because you can go out and get the Super Nintendo game for like $10-15. Why would you spend $100 on it just to get a sticker? I could see them doing that with like a Mega Man X. Maybe they already planned that. I forget.
Yeah.
But I think there's going to be a market for maybe official re-releases of games that weren't distributed wildly, but are popular now, cult hits on certain consoles. Maybe you get a licensed reproduction of Little Samson, for example, where you can go and spend $10-12 on a cheap knockoff, or you get the collector's edition for $50-60, and that could fulfill a need.
And what's really important about this is that it sort of straddles the line between it's a functional game, but then also, you know, it's if you've looked, if you've seen one of the I Am 8-Bit, you know, Street Fighter 2s up close, it's really nice. Like the you know, the foil, the embossed printing on the box has the fold-out thing. It's like that's something that you, you know, you can put it on your desk at work and it's not a Funko Pop, basically.
You're afraid of these pointing out a bunch of Funko Pops. Speaking of all the counterfeits from the Alibaba or AliExpress counterfeits.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that make a dent into the retro gaming market, or is that sort of separate? Do you feel people that maybe would not be big collectors, I want to buy a bunch of $8, $10 knockoff games?
Well, I see a lot of people who are collectors who buy mostly real stuff, and then they're like, oh, but you know, I bought a repro of, you know, Hagane because I just want to have it on my shelf, and I don't really care if it's real or not. And I think this is going to start affecting things in like 5 to 10 years, because it's not just guys sitting at home making a dozen repros of a game anymore. It's the AliExpress and, like, you know, companies in China that are pumping these things out.
Sure.
Give it a while, give it a few years for them to sell tons and tons and tons of these, then let them get into people's collections. And then as those people that are buying these start getting out of collecting and selling, the market gets flooded with fakes. And I think I don't quite know what that's going to do, but yeah, it will affect things, and it will make a lot harder to go and, like, you know, right now, if I wanted to buy somebody's collection of games, I go to their house, look at the collection, and I don't have to wonder, is this fake? It's like, you know, it's real. All you're really worried about is the value at that point, or what am I going to pay for this? But 10 years from now, if somebody says, hey, I got a big collection of Super Nintendo games, do you want to buy it? You go in, and you're going to look at it all, and you're going to have to start asking yourself with each individual game, you're going to have to start looking at it and saying, is this a fake or not? Because it's going to be so flooded, it's going to be ridiculous.
Well, thankfully, the quality isn't what the original.
Yeah. Well, that's why it becomes very important. You have to know your stuff. You have to be constantly learning about, you know, I mean, really, you don't need to know what a fake looks like. You need to know what a real one looks like.
Correct.
And then when you get a fake in your hands, you're going to be like, this is off. This is wrong.
Collar's off. It just feels off. The weight's off before you even have to. Sometimes they don't have the labels on the back. So you'll be able to easily know.
You're going
to
be immediately like, wait a minute, something's wrong with this. And that's going to tell you to look deeper into it.
I wonder if it's going to erode confidence overall in the collecting market at all, or it's just going to always be separate, or it's always going to be like people always say, oh, it's like this, the reason why me and Ian hate repro labels, because it's always like, well, it's just for me and no one else. Well, it's like, no, you're going to sell it at some point. And then
that's right.
It's not passed along, and they're going to pass it along. You know, it's, and so
I think that a lot of people have this very strange idea that the things that they buy, they're like never going to sell them. And they're literally, their family is going to get an extra large coffin and put their body in it and then fill up all the remaining space with their Super Nintendo games. For some reason, they think this is going to happen. It's like, what do you think is going to, you're, it's like, and it's, and also it's not even going to be when you die. You're going to sell this in 10 years. You're going to sell this in 20 years. Like, you're eventually going to sell this stuff.
Oh,
everything,
man,
gets sold. Everybody who says, I'll never, never, never in a million years sell my stuff, your stuff gets sold.
Yep, my stuff will be
sold.
So
what are you going to do about it?
I'm going to snap probably within a few years, and my stuff will be sold to, you know, afford my care, probably.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I had this conversation.
Those mental hospitals are expensive.
I mean, I had this conversation myself even before I moved. I knew it was coming. But obviously, moving puts things in perspective. When you're packing up a few thousand games, you're like, oh, okay. Like, I have so many PC games that I didn't realize I had. Like,
yeah,
that I picked up at this flea markets where no one else would buy them. And I would tell the seller, I'm the only person buying these, and not just a lowball. I'm just like, hey, listen, because they always go, hey, can I sell these? It's like, nah, you can sell them. Okay, I'll just buy them and I'll offer you something. So I have boxes upon boxes of sometimes sealed PC games from the 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this stuff like, I'm going to die with this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, even in that, I won't be able to sell.
Well, don't. Don't die with your stuff. Like, take care of your affairs while you're still alive.
But at some point, though, the stuff goes to someone else. And then at some point, there's no one else that wants this stuff. And that's what I'm trying to impart on people now when it comes to these retro game collections. Where at some point, because me and Ian, we were asked a question about video game collectors, why do, I think the question was, I don't know if it was Loaded or Strongman, but why do collectors think their games are going to end up in museums? And there's some collectors that honestly think my entire collection will end up in a museum. And they won't. Some people, parts of some people's collections will end up in museums. Most won't. Some,
your
some
collections can end up in a museum right now. There are several museums in the United States that will take all your stuff right now. No problem.
They'll run out of space, and there's way too many games out there. I think that's the point I'm going to get to.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's not everybody's collections.
Yes. So, like, at some point, it's like, okay, even if you want to get one of every game that's out there.
Right.
Okay. What about the other million people who have the same games?
That's right.
What happens to their games 100 years from now, or even 20 years from now? And so I'm trying to make people, I'm trying to sort of let people down easily in the shock of that, you know, you value these games probably as much as anyone in the history of the world will ever value these games in your collection right now. So if you're going to get rid of them, either do it now or don't think you're going to retire on them in 30 years or enjoy them. And those are probably the most realistic options you have right now.
Yep.
In your life, because physical media as a whole is dying, which means the value of physical media is dying overall, even to us right now, the last generation who really grew up with it, or even a generation behind us if we're roughly the same age. So my point is that at some point these games are going to sit somewhere, and it's just something where I right now I'm like, okay, I have 300 Genesis games. I will never play all 300 of these Genesis games. Mm-hmm. So maybe I cut it down to 150. You know, is that reasonable? Maybe with even my OCD, I'll allow myself to do that. Do I really need NBA Showdown on Genesis and Super Nintendo? Probably not. I probably will never play it on one of the systems, if not both. So I'm finally getting that into my head, where it's okay to let go of some of this stuff.
I'm in the same place that I feel like eventually or probably sometime soon. Because right now, if I get doubles, I sell doubles. But if I don't have the game, I just keep it. I'll keep it.
And that's in San Francisco, where the cost per square foot's $1 billion.
yeah, exactly. Well, I have a storage unit, which probably costs a lot more here than it does in elsewhere. But at this point, it's not really an issue to just hold on to, you know, one copy of every game. And I really do my best to not have two copies of anything. You know, if I have a double, I move it out. But I'm getting to the point where it's like, do I want to start selling things where I only have one copy of it? And if so, what is that stuff? And what do I want to do with it?
Sure.
So eventually I will probably start paring down, especially just because, as we've said, prices are going up. It's probably, and it's like, I desire tons of games less than I have. I like the idea of maybe being more curated with it.
That's where I'm getting. So like, for example, I have a limited number of shelves here for this room. And so my problem in the past was that, you know, I'd have games squirreled away in those like white Rubbermaid stackable drawers or whatever. And it's like, that's not really respectful to the games that I'm not really going to dig through and play a random ass 32X game. So really, should I just curate down to the games that I see or the ones I'm probably going to probably play or appreciate? I'm kind of getting to that point. I have 200 boxed NES games sitting in the garage that I also have the cartridge of and the manual. And I just have them there. And it's like, I don't need them. Like, I know I don't need them. I should probably sell them and someone else can enjoy. I mean, even my I have a Kid Klown Complete. That's like, I don't really need that.
You know, yeah. I think this is probably the time.
No, it absolutely is the time
to sell.
Yes,
NES. I think that we have hit, in general, peak NES. I think we hit it a while ago.
We hit it a year and a half ago.
Yeah. And I mean, everybody said. I mean, I was just like, you know, look at what happened with Atari, and everybody's like, no, that won't happen with NES. Nintendo is different. Nintendo isn't Atari. Atari's not culturally relevant anymore. Nintendo is culturally relevant. The same thing is not going to happen. Don't worry. Oh, look, it's happening on the exact same cycle as what happened with Atari, because the Atari collectors went crazy. They bought up stuff, hitting its peak in like 2007, 2008. Then it kind of started coming down again. NES hit its peak. It's coming down again. And what happens is the rarest of the rare, you get to a point where It's best or nothing. And now this happens a lot in collectibles. There's people still collecting NES, but they want either the best, either they're going to pay a record amount for a sealed hang tab Super Mario Brothers, going to pay $30,000 for it, or they're not going to pay anything for it. So with Atari, the same thing happened. Air Raid. If an Air Raid were to come up today, it would hit another record, right? It would probably set another record.
For boxed, but, or like, you mean just loose?
For a boxed. Okay. For a boxed complete with a manual Air Raid, people would probably pay potentially about what they paid last time or more, because that stuff will keep going up. But the loose stuff, I mean, all of the, I mean, you know, you could sell Contra at one point for $40. Loose Contra. Those days are extremely over, and we've hit the crest on NES. It's coming down, and it's gonna happen to Super Nintendo, and then it'll happen to Nintendo 64.
Absolutely. I think people forget that the volume of the games out there versus the number of new collectors that are coming in versus the ones leaving. And if our generation of NES collectors isn't replaced, then there's no one else for them to go to. That's my whole point about ending up in the museum or where do they end up.
Right.
And no, I talked to, this is not just collectors, I talked to store owners. They're like, yeah, NES peaked in like summer 2016. I've had multiple people tell me that. You look at the prices, and yeah, even like the Little Samsons and Dinosaur Peaks, they stopped going up, and they've even dropped a little bit. But all the common-ass popular games have come down in price. And what does that tell you? Everyone who wants Contra original copy is not going to pay what you think they're going to pay, so most people have it or are satisfied by now.
Yeah.
And that's even happened with stuff like Earthbound. Ian told me in Portland, the last Portland he went to, he said Earthbounds were not selling. He said, that tells me something. If an Earthbound's not selling at a retro game convention, what does that tell you? And that's a game that has come down even for a popular game like that. That used to peak at like 250, 260, and now it's...
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things in play, but if we don't replace the generation of collectors with the next, the value just goes down. And
yeah,
so,
we will. I mean, so the thing is, each generation of collectors wants something else. So the people who are like, the people who are turning 30 now want Super Nintendo. And the people that are going to be turning 30 in 5 years will remember fondly Nintendo 64. But then once we get into GameCube era, it's entirely possible that those people coming in are going to want to collect something else, because a lot of stuff from PS2 GameCube era was kept in really good condition, you know? And so the things that become collectible are the things that got thrown away back in the day. So it could be something else entirely, but yeah, it's the typical collecting cycle, and this is what's happening.
I'm glad we agree on this.
I'm not. Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's like if you are holding on to boxes upon boxes of NES games, thinking that you were going to retire off of them 50 years from now, like you may have actually missed the boat in terms of the peak time to sell that stuff off. I have everything except for stadium events. I don't have the, not unlicensed, but all the licensed stuff except for stadium events. I have most unlicensed, but like I'm not looking to go and, like, you know, hoard and get multiple copies of that, because that's over, and Super Nintendo will be over soon too.
Yeah, there's a finite number of time, and a lot of times the prices of these games increase because you get the new speculators and investors in. I mean, it was like probably 4 or 5 years ago when you had a lot more people get into NES, and you had, I call them insta-collectors, where they would just get an entire set of NES games in a year. So that just drove the price up because they weren't willing to be patient, like me or you were. It's like, okay, I'm not going to spend... my most famous story is Kid Clown being one of the last licensed games I needed. And there was Buy It Nows. I remember two or three were like Hillbilly Media. Maybe you heard of them. And I think they were trying to corner the market on it. And that did happen with some eBay sellers. They would buy up all the ones they saw and jack the price.
Yeah, so they would try.
And sometimes it worked. And in the case of Kid Clown, there was never a copy on eBay. This is back in like 2007, 2008.
Yep.
And I refused to hit that $45 buy it now. And then finally one came on an open auction. I got it for $11. And I was just like, there you go. So I was like, oh, this is what's going on. And that's before the buy it nows became the standard, which helped dictate price as well and sort of set ceilings, which is a whole other conversation psychologically. Right. But getting off on a tangent. But I think people that wanted to benefit the most off of the prices getting jacked were also the ones helping to jack the prices as quickly as they could. It was like a weird effect going on. But I think that's even died out as well, because the price of admission now is not what it was in 2012, you know, but now we're finally seeing the tail off, where I've seen big time collectors sell off a lot of their games that got into it 2012, 2013, and now they're getting out. I have seen it. I've seen it happen.
Well, no, sure. No, I mean, people, but the thing is, people are always selling collections and then people are always getting into it, right? And so it's just a question of what are the trends? Like, is it trend, yeah. are prices trending upwards in general? I think you can even go to pricecharting.com and you can find a chart that literally just takes the average of every retro game that they cover and you can look and see where that's going. If that line starts to dip downwards, then I'd start to get worried.
Well, you have to do it by system, I think, to really know the trends and the volume of each system, because there's more NES collectors out there than there are Sega Saturn collectors. So I think that's really where you have to look at, okay, what are the main systems and what are people doing with it? You know, you're always going to have Atari Jaguar collectors, but honestly, who cares what they do, because there's like 14 of them.
I think, I think that's where you're going to see the biggest kind of dropout is stuff like Atari Jaguar, where it never really had a fan base. You know, it's really, it became a collecting phenomenon. Whereas, I mean, NES, like, we talk about NES being at its peak. It's not like it's like plummeting down into the depths of nothing. It's, you know, Super Mario Brothers and things like that, the things that people do fondly remember, are still going to have an audience and wanting to buy stuff, but it's just a question of the overall trend. But like something like Atari Jaguar, where again it's literally just like no one cares and they were blowing these things out and really nobody cared about it, it's, you know, that's really going to be a problem.
Yeah, I just go back to, again, you go by the popular games on a system, and that's really like where I like to define it, because those games are so readily available yet people wanted them. So that's why I say a game like Contra, for example, has come down like 30-40%. I think it peaked at like $48-50, something like that. And that came down.
And people are going to start moving away. I mean, you know, there was this whole, I mean, you know, in the 2000s, in the early part of this decade, if you wanted to play NES games, I mean, you were either playing it on an emulator on your computer, which was iffy, or, you know, you could buy an NES and hook it up to your TV at home. And people were doing that a lot. They wanted the cartridges because they wanted to play it. And I think we're getting a lot more of a separation now, where people realize, you know, you don't have to own the original cartridge to play these games. And not only that, but it's like a real pain in the ass to try to do that.
Yes.
And the better thing to do is just, you know, either buy an analog mini NT or use an emulator or use a Raspberry Pi or whatever and just do it like that. And the idea of like having this whole collection of cartridges that you need to reference, it's so cumbersome. Especially as people are moving digital with their music collections and dumping all their CDs too.
Absolutely. And that's, there's a documentary I'm helping out with that's looking at that, about, you know, the death of physical media. And that also means the eventual death of mom and pop game shops. You're going to see it retract. And I think it has retracted a little bit. I don't have a lot of data to go off of. I think it blew up and it retracted. Definitely happened at my local flea market. I'd say the peak of my flea market, it went from one or two retro game sellers to six or seven.
Yeah.
Around, I want to say 2013, six or seven. Then within about a year or two, they realized, hey, we're all selling the same games for the same exact prices. Because guess what? They made a billion Mario Kart 64s. So how can we all charge $35 or $30 on it? So then it went back to one or two, and now it's down to one. So you see the people that got into it because they knew it was sexy. People that were maybe people that dealt with other media like DVDs or CDs, they saw it. But now they're like, okay, now the price of admission is higher even for me to acquire the stuff. Now I'm out. So you see usually the first people in are the last ones to usually leave it. And you have the last ones in are usually the first out, from what I see with this stuff. And the same thing with the collectors. So me and you will be old and gray and still, you know, own our weird ass stuff that goes into the coffin with us. Well, Miami.
Will I? I don't know. You know, I mean, for me, it's like I got to figure out. It's like I really have to, you know, do the soul searching and say, what is the long game here? Like, what is... where do I see this ending up and when, and then working towards that goal? Do I have things that I think should go to a museum? Absolutely.
Sure.
You know, and it's, but it's like the cream of the crop type stuff. Yeah. It's the really, really good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. My NWC cards, like I can, any museum, I can put them on loan or whatever, or give eventually if I wanted to. Be a nice, huge tax write off. But like, like I said, like, who's going to want my box Ninja Kid? Who's going to want that in a museum? Like, is that going to be a piece? Oh, 1986 NES games. Is there going to be a curated collection of that? Probably not.
Yeah. You know? I think a lot of... No, I mean, I think museums, universities, I mean, they will want to keep some of that stuff around. Hey, boxed Ninja Kids. It's hard to find a Ninja Kid box. It is. It's difficult.
Chubby Cherub, that was a tougher one to find, but they probably made roughly the same amount of those. That was a tough one for me to get, Chubby Cherub. I sold my scoon anyway. So do you agree though that, you know, with the eventual death of physical media, we're now seeing it with with movies and TV shows. It's coming quicker than I thought. I always say, like, probably within even 5 years, you may not be able to buy a Blu-ray anymore. You know, that might be
it's certainly possible. Yeah. I mean, just watching people dump CDs like crazy and just, you know, and find all kinds of CDs at thrift stores now.
Oh, sure.
And I'm crazy for buying stuff, but like they can't even sell them. So it's like, I'll get, you know, good music, especially things that are where I'm like, you know, this isn't on iTunes. This isn't something that's on Amazon. You know, I'll buy this. But yeah, I do see people dumping more physical media. I think that does extend to games. I mean, the thing that I would just tell everybody is, you know, have fun collecting video games, but be smart. Like, don't get caught up in, like, speculative mania, because it's not going to be good for you. Like, do what makes sense for your own finances, and only buy these things if you really are having a good time doing it and you really think that you want these things, and don't feel pressured. Because I think one of the things that kind of scares me about like online collecting culture right now is people looking at, either Reddit game collecting or YouTube or anything and saying, oh, I want to be part of this online community. So what I got to do is I got to go out and spend money I don't have on games I don't want, and take pictures of it and post it online, to be a part of the community that I'm collecting games. And it's like, you don't have to do that. It's okay to not buy things that you may not necessarily actually want.
Do you think that's a part of the rise in this over the past 5-6 years? Is literally people just want to be part of a club or online bragging about, hey, I'm in the little Samson club now.
I think that there, because people
would tweet at
of,
me that or send me messages. Hey Pat, I got a little Samson. What do you want me to say? Congratulations, you spent $900 on eBay. What do you want exactly? You want me to say?
Right. No, I absolutely think that there is, and it's not. You know, of course, you know, everybody wants to feel like they're part of a community. But when it gets to the point where if you are spending money that you don't have on things that you don't want to be part of that community, it's like, you know, don't buy a little Samson to impress Pat, right? Like it's you don't have to do that. Pat's not impressed. And you know, it's like, it's all right. Like it's okay to do it the way that you want to do it.
Yes. Go at your own pace. Don't spend your rent money. So I'm glad me and Chris agree on that. Mm-hmm.
You know, remember that you will die one day, and no, you know what I mean? Like, just figure out, like, what is the end game here? Because the end game is probably not you passing it down to your children. Because you hear that from a lot of people, like, oh, I'm going to pass it down to my kids. It's like, your kids probably don't want your stuff. Like, a lot, what tends to happen is, you get old and you die, and all your house full of possessions ends up becoming a burden on your adult children. And they're like, oh, we got to get rid of all granddad's stuff. And they end up selling it for pennies on the dollar because they have to get rid of it.
It's better for
you to sell it because you're the one who knows what it's worth.
I think about when my grandparents died and they had like the big yard sale in the back with all the trinkets and stuff they had. They probably had old silverware, old china, depression glass. And it's like, yeah, that's valuable to some people, but you got to find those specific people that want to spend that money. Otherwise, you're basically giving the crap away to get rid of it. Yeah.
How much of your day, you know, how many days, how many weeks, months are you going to be able to take out of your life to sell all their stuff and make sure that they're getting top value out of it? It's like, you got to get rid. You got to get it gone. Yeah.
There's time is
sometimes
time
because
is
because you got to sell the house.
Yeah.
So you got to sell the stuff before you can sell the house. And it's like, it has to get it gone. And even if there is something valuable, you don't have the time to do it.
And I tell people that in terms of negotiating tips, it's like, know the market of some of these game systems. It's like, you have a lot more wiggle room when it's a system that you know that not many people are into. Or you can, if someone throws an eBay price at you, you can be like, yeah, that eBay price is for such a small subsection of collectors, and most of them already have that game, so please work with me. You know, it's a lot different negotiating a Super Nintendo game that's hard to find versus, I don't know,
that's right,
Odyssey 2 game, you know, or Intellivision. You know, there's different sizes of market, or Atari Lynx. You know, so you have to be wary of that, but also be wary of that when you value your collection. When you say, oh, my collection is worth this amount of money, I'd be like, does
that... Oh, you know, I just saw that. I just saw, like, somebody had posted on some forum, and they had used a collection tracker that pulls in values from price charting, and they're like, well, I only spent $2,000 on my collection, but it's worth $8,000. And then they had a screenshot, and it's like Atari 2600 with 30 games, and it's like they have 30 games, and that screenshot is showing their 30 Atari 2600 games worth $200. And it's like, well, sure, if you take eBay costs, you know, an eBay price of each, this game was $3, this game was $4, and you multiply that times 30, you get to $200. But try to sell those 30 games for $200.
And this,
just try it. Just try to do it.
And this is funny because this is why someone who appeared on Storage Wars went after me, because I questioned their valuation of Atari games at $10 each. Random ass 2600 and 5200 games $10 each, when the average price is probably $1.20, something like that. But speaking of that, I forgot to bring this up. I can honestly say 2017 was the first year where I saw NES games priced like 2600 games, where I saw boxes of dollar NES games for sale.
Interesting.
First
where
year.
Where did you see that?
Two conventions. I saw it at a Syracuse convention.
Two conventions?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I have. Like, I don't have that many NES games because I, like, you know, that you see the prices coming down, but it's like, I've got a little pile of NES games that I was bringing to collections. They're not moving. Like, nobody seems to want to buy them. I'm probably going to do them 50% off the next time I sell stuff just to get rid of them.
We are approaching that point. I tell people, this isn't the majority of the library, but there's going to be a good 200 NES games that are going to be dollar games. We are fast approaching that point.
Yep, and you're not going to be able to sell them for a dollar.
And they're not all trash games either. They're not all trash games. Estaniacs.
Yep. They're just...
Not a trash game. It's a dollar game, though. It's going to hit that point.
But I totally agree. I think that a lot of vendors have, especially if you're bigger, you know, bigger vendors, you've probably been sitting on a lot of NES games that you have been, you know, you take all the NES games, you bring them to the convention, you sell what you can, you take back the rest, and you repeat and repeat and repeat. But after the last few years, I'm guessing that a lot of people have seen the same thing that I saw, which is nobody's touching them, nobody's buying them at all, and you're hauling the same box or two boxes or 10 boxes, and you got to mark them down.
But the same is for uncommon and rare games, which is why I'm like, okay, I think we're hitting the critical mass point of the collectors having what they need. There was three or four copies of Blackjack on the NES, which is a rare game. It's probably rarer than people think.
Yeah, and that was one of the last of the AVE games that I needed. It's pretty rare.
So out of those four copies, I saw too many games last year. I think only one had sold the whole weekend.
Okay.
And they weren't asking an exorbitant amount. They were asking maybe what it was worth, like 20, 25 bucks or whatever. And no one wanted it. So what does that tell you? It's like there's no desire for the game.
It's only valuable if you are trying to piece together every single unlicensed. And who is trying to do that anymore? And why would you even try to do that? So yeah, it's not Super Mario Brothers like that. At least a copy of Super Mario Brothers is going to hold on to some kind of value for quite a long time,
sure,
just because of the significance and because enough people will want to have a copy of that.
So you hear first from Chris, panic and sell your games right now and crash the market.
Get out. No. That's, yeah.
Because I always surmise that it probably would only take about three or four big collectors to do that, and that would sort of sour the market in general. It would be like, that would be enough probably to have that many games out there where it's like, okay.
I mean, you know, again, we don't really know what percentage of collectors out there are actually speculating, because a lot of people lie to themselves. They say, oh, I'm not speculating. I'm going to keep this forever. But then the second prices start to go down, they dump. And it's like, you were speculating. you weren't being honest with yourself about it. But you were buying this thinking the price is going to go up and up and up and then I'm going to retire. But in fact, the price dipped a little bit and you dumped. And that's what happens with a speculative mania. It's that as soon as prices start to go down, everybody dumps everything.
So I think we might hit that over the next few years, depending on what system it is. But I think we'll see 10, 20 years away from the Elvis collectibles phase, Or it's like,
yeah, well, the thing with the Elvis collectibles thing is that everybody died. So, I mean, you don't have to worry that your collection doesn't have any value anymore because you're dead.
Because grandma just died, or your aunt Phyllis died, and all their stuff.
No, you personally. I mean, grandma the one who had all the Elvis stuff. And it's like you go to a gravesite and be like, grandma, you'll never believe it. Your copy of Hunka Hunka Burnin' Love is only worth $10, not $100 anymore. Grandma says nothing because she's dead. She doesn't care at that point.
But then who do you give it to? The collectible plates. Who do they go to?
Right.
Oh, man. I hope it's not like that.
Straight,
but that's
right into the dump.
So, yeah, I hope you love your stuff.
Yeah.
So what else was going to talk about? We won't get into the grading stuff too much. We went back and forth on Twitter, the great Twitter VGA debate of 2018.
Yeah, I don't look. Here's my position on this. I don't own many sealed games, and so basically, what happened on Twitter was that I posted that I had a couple of sealed games, had a Mega Man 5 for NES, I had a first run of like Final Fantasy 7, and I'm like, you know what? I'm really I'm so into collecting. I've never ever done this, and I've got just a couple of sealed games that are would go for a lot of money. I also have a toddler, and they can take the shrink wrap off a game in 2 seconds flat. I'm going to actually really, and also I've had a lot of questions over the years about what's up with this VGA thing, what is it like, what happens, and I'm like, I don't personally know. And so I'm going to do this with a few games, and see how it goes. And I can certainly say that the people who work there are super professional, really communicative, very, very, they run their business really, really well. So if somebody's thinking of doing it, I would say they really take care of your stuff. They are super well, they document everything. You should at least not worry that you're sending your stuff into a black hole. Like, I feel like they were very good and professional. And I don't care about the grading. Like, I don't care about the actual, this is an 80. Like, I don't even know what my games came back graded. I saw they had grades on them. I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. I really care about the idea of, they're third-party authenticated, which means that if I do sell them, anybody who would actually consider buying them, all they have to do is glance at it, and they go, that's sealed. It's not a question of them having to look over the seal and make their own determination at that point, because if you understand that that game is sealed if it's in a VGA case. And that was kind of it for me.
Well, she said that on Twitter. Would have saved us some time. I don't actually
say that on Twitter.
No, you didn't.
You're too busy yelling at me.
I agree with what you said. I think, again, my main issue is, like, I even posted the video that me and Ian we talked about why we don't agree with it. It's that you're not actually, at the end of the day, grading the contents of the game.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
And that's where it's materially not the same as grading. We always liken it to comic books, since that was like comic books and baseball cards and coins were the first major markets, where it's like you are grading the entire aspect of the device. You're really just grading, for the most part, the seal on it. I mean, unless the...
Yeah. That's right.
Because people don't bother usually to grade seal games that are really banged up. They usually don't freaking bother,
Mm-hmm.
No, I agree. The cases are high quality. The cases are great. My NWCs are encased in those. I got them custom made, but I didn't get them sealed. That's the difference. I was like,
you get it sealed if you want. I mean, they have to seal it because the certificate of authenticity has to be with it somehow. And typically what they do with collectibles, like if you have a baseball with an autograph on it, they'll put a little sticker on the baseball that says, this is the serial number and this goes with this certificate. And then if you remove the serial number, it's good. But with a video game, with a sealed game, you can't do that, because as soon as you put a sticker on the seal, you're harming it.
Yeah, I think the problem is the market forces driving it. And that's really the issue I think that most people have with it, is because you have an artificial inflation that happens due to people getting something graded, and there's a cost associated with that, whatever it is, $60 a game, something mm-hmm. like that. Then all of a sudden, people place an arbitrary value on that, saying, okay, this is what the VGA 85 is, or 90 plus. Mm-hmm. And people are like, wait a second. Like, what are we talking about here? Because if I try to find a sealed version of this game, I can probably get it for a lot less. So what exactly, what is the valuation going on here?
I personally don't get it. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, if you want But I just say live and let live. If people want to go nuts paying too much money for a VGA 95, you know, version of something like that, go right ahead and be crazy with
oh,
your
sure.
money.
Oh, sure. No, I think that's what people have an issue with, and people that are, I mean, it happens with comic books too, where you get something brand new and you get them graded. Like, that to me blows my mind. It's like anything brand new, there's a billion of them that are unopened at this point.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Don't
I mean, that's,
to get
that's,
sealed.
But, I don't play with that. I don't get into that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not at all in that world. I'm guessing that there are people, and I think that those might be people who are speculating, who are like getting, you know, 10 copies of New Super Mario Brothers DS and getting them all VGA graded in the hopes that, you know, later on, you know, 20 years from now, they're going to have $1 million worth of games on their hands. And I don't think that that's true.
Yeah, that they're looking at basically where the comic market got in the mid-90s, where people started buying 10 copies of mass-produced items that are worthless now that you can't give
away.
Yeah,
I once went into a store, like a collectible store, and there was all these boxes of comics, okay? I'm like, okay, there's boxes of comics. And I start looking through, and literally it's just like multiple copies of issue number one of a million different comics from the 90s. And the guy was like, oh, yeah, I was just buying 5 to 10 copies of the first issue of all of these different comics.
In case one was thinking, worth money.
thinking that they're the old. First issue of everything was always going to be worth money. Whereas in reality, it's actually reversed, because for a lot of 90s comics, it's the last issue with the lowest print run that actually ends up being worth the money.
Interesting, Chris. I didn't want to look into that. Meanwhile,
this guy just has all these things that he can't sell for anything, because it was like, well, you're a fool.
All the Chromium Ninjak number ones by Valiant, which I probably bought, but probably bought to read, thinking, oh, you know, this could be worth money. No, it's not. And nope. I think that's the lesson to learn is that stuff. So,
but that's what's going on now. And I don't really know the extent of it in video games. It's probably not quite as crazy as the comics were, because the comics, they print God knows how many of those things they were printing that people were snapping up and holding on to.
Oh, absolutely.
But in games right now, if you look at the limited run games, all the other companies that are doing all these sort of limited, not even limited editions, just like, oh, we're only going to print 5,000 of this game that you don't care about and would never buy, but for the fact that we're telling you that we're only ever going to print 6,000 of them. Like, that's a speculation bubble. And I will definitely say I got into it a little bit with the limited run games, because I was like, oh, that's really cool. They're only going to print a certain amount of these. I'll buy these. And after 20 of those, I was like, I'm getting out of this. I'm selling these limited run games. I'm buying and holding on to the ones where I like the game, like Oddworld, stuff like that. But like the rest of it, no, thank you.
I do know there are people that are buying every single one. I mean, hell,
there's a lot of people who are.
They bring their extra stock to conventions. And I know the guys, Douglas and Josh, great guys, and I like what they're doing. But yeah, most of their stuff sells out at conventions. It just goes by the first day. It's gone. And it's like, huh, who's buying that stuff? But I like what they're doing, because it is an outlet for preservation for digital only titles.
Oh, that's
extremely
right.
Important.
It's great. It's great that they're doing it in that sense, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So even for that, I don't care. People speculate and buy every copy. At least we know we're going to have physical versions of some of these games. Otherwise,
that's right.
We won't. Down the line. And I think,
but again, if you are convincing yourself that you are building a nice little retirement package for yourself by owning all the limited run games, those are all going to get dumped when everybody dumps their PS4. I mean, dumped as in like given away to thrift stores.
I think the better analogy to limited run games, and not disparaging the product, but I mean what people are valuing it at, would be like those 80s collector plates.
Absolutely.
Where you have these small markets where everyone's frenzy. Oh, I want to get the next generation collector's place too. Oh, these other ones have gone up in value? Really? Yeah, because it's the same people buying all of them. So it's like its own little insulated market. That's the way I see it, at least. Where it's going to be hard to transfer those outside of that little market to someone else to see the same value. It's like, oh.
Again, and there's people now who are like, I'm gonna get every game on the Switch. I'm gonna buy every game on the Switch, and it's like you're gonna buy them as they come out at $50 each. Like, you think that's a good idea? And there's people who were doing that, and it's like, okay, have fun with that, because what's gonna happen when the Switch, you know, becomes obsolete in 5 to 10 years, somewhere in the middle there, like all that stuff is gonna go down in value. That's the time to buy it. right now is the time to buy Wii.
Yes.
You know, a year from now is the time to buy Wii U. But it's not the time to buy it when they're actually publishing it.
And the good news is for a lot of those Wii U games, you'll be able to buy them brand new, old stock, instead of getting them used. Probably you'll be able to find them somewhere.
Yeah, Wii U might be the collectible. I mean, Wii U, I think, actually will be the Nintendo collectible of whatever, you know, 10, 20 years from now, because it's like the Vectrex, you know what I mean? Like, they barely made any of them.
Okay, barely is a strong word, but okay, I see what you're saying.
They break. I mean, if the Wii U, if your gamepad controller breaks, that's it. The whole system is shot. And they never made any more of the gamepads. They never sold them separately. So there's one gamepad per system, and if the gamepad breaks, whole thing shot. So, I mean, they're fragile. You have to have the gamepad. It has to work. It's like there's just, and there's not that many of them. It is the lowest selling Nintendo home console by 10 miles.
Not counting Virtual Boy.
It's got a few good games. Yeah, well, no, home console. Okay. It's got a few good games, and, you know, it does have games people like. And there's a very small library of physical games. So people will, in 10, 20 years, want to collect a Wii U and all the games for it. So I would say hold on to them, but like I wouldn't be spending tons of money on it.
No, I wouldn't either, because what was that awfully reviewed game that people started snatching up and went up to $100 and they did the second print of it?
They did one reprint. Oh, yeah. Also, I mean, you know, a very important lesson for collectors is it's not collectible if the printing press is still on.
Yes.
Because everybody collected Rez for PS2, and then they're like, oh, let's make more. Like, oh, look, this costs $200. Let's make more of them.
Is that,
so they did.
But isn't the danger for any disc-based game going forward is that they can make 100% accurate?
No, because they're not making PS1 games anymore. Like, that's over.
But
right?
PS2, they can.
I think they still... Yeah,
they are.
Because Sega just reprinted Yakuza and Yakuza 2.
That's the whole point.
So you can still get PS2 games printed. So be very careful when buying... Rule of Rose costs like $200 on PS2, and it is not out of the question that, like, at some point, Atlas might go, oh, we did another run of Rule of Rose and tank the whole thing.
Yeah.
Be very careful with that. PS1 at this point, I'm pretty sure that's over.
You're pretty sure PS1. It'd be hard to replicate that.
You can't just call up Sony and make another PS1 game anymore. Like, that's done.
That's done.
But PS2, you can.
But PS2, you can.
As evidenced by Yakuza.
And in theory... they'll be able to do the same thing with Wii U. I'm not saying Nintendo would be likely to allow that easily, but you know.
I sincerely I
or GameCube.
Sincerely doubt
or GameCube
that well, GameCube is over. Wii and Wii U, you can probably still get runs of. Oh no, I mean, you can still make Wii games because Ubisoft still releases Just Dance on the Wii.
That was the last game, wasn't it?
So no, but they keep coming out with it every year.
I thought Just Sing was it Just Sing 2016 was the last one.
No, everybody said Just Sing. It's the last Wii game. The last Wii game. But then another Just Dance came out, and then another one came out after that.
Because they probably figured, hey, if we do 10,000 Wii versions, it doesn't cost us anything, or 25,000, someone might buy it still.
Just Dance 2018 came out on the Wii.
You gotta be kidding me.
Not even kidding.
I might have to buy that. Just because.
And it came out on the Wii U. They might do Just Dance 2019 on the Wii U. It's entirely possible. So as long as those printing presses are still on, they could go back and print more of anything.
$34 on Amazon.
Don't spend $150 on Hello Kitty cruisers for the Wii U, as some people are doing.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Until you know, because they could always just make more. So just watch out. Just be careful with that.
I think that's where it's going to be the definition of how collectible will these systems be. When you look at something like the Wii, that was hugely popular. Lots of shovelware, but still had some nice games. But everyone had it. Lots of people had the Wii. Will there be people going gung-ho, I want to get every Wii game 5-10 years from now? And...
yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
It's gonna be a very small number of people, though.
I think that's sort of things. Like, I think the nostalgia level for these systems will more transfer to the individual games versus the entire feeling of the system itself.
Like PC gaming,
exactly.
Basically. Yeah.
That's where I see these ending up, and that's
why. There's just too much stuff.
There's too much stuff, and it's like, well, you know, no one even buys any physical media anymore, so why should I have 8 walls of white Wii games in front of me?
You got to have a lot of space for the complete Wii.
I don't even think about that. All these cases. Think about it. Well, even PS2. What is that? 2,500 games if you want to get every PS2 game? That's insane.
Yeah. It's way too, yeah, it's too crazy.
Man, we're the dying breed of completionist collectors here. By the way, I still need that Master System Buster Douglas manual. Still got to find
that. Oh, man. Well, actually, I mean, honestly, you know what? Again, like, nothing has really happened with the Buster Douglas price either, so I guess
it went up a little bit.
Okay. Okay.
But not that
but
much.
But it's still gonna come down like NES is. So just, you know,
I'll do what you did. You pawn off your crappy version to someone and buy complete again. That's what you did to me.
That's what every Master System collector has to do. It's like, because you accidentally, when you're collecting Master System, you're like, oh, okay, well. Okay, well, this game doesn't have a manual, but that's fine. I'll get this, and I'll put it into my collection, and I'll get the manual later. And then you realize that you can't, so you have to sell the... You have to buy a CIB and sell the CB.
By the way, just to let you know, there's been a couple of the... Now we're getting into the weeds on Master System. There's been a couple...
Yeah. That's how you know the podcast is over.
That's how you know it's dying. But there's been a couple of the Sonic US versions with the UPC on eBay lately.
Yeah.
There's a sealed one up right now, and there was one that...
Is there a sealed one up right now?
Yeah.
I gotta go look at that.
I don't know what it's
really.
Which I'm interested. I'd be interested to take a look at that. But there, one, I think one sold recently that was opened up for $600. It was a $600 buy it now. It was on there for a while. I looked at it. It was on there for a while, and someone just said, "Okay, I need it. I bought it." So I'm like, I'm not sure that's a good price or not because of that, because it's a buy it now. These never come up for sale. And I know we spoke about it before, and about you know how many of these were out there. Were these done at certain stores? Was this every copy in the U.S.? Like, was it a subset? It's extremely interesting in this case because there's so few of these out there. There's just so few of them that you find with the UPC.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious to see where the sealed ones ends up. To me, a sealed Master System game is worth just the same as a regular. But in the case of this, since this is a special case, you know, who knows what it goes up for.
That sticker looks bad to me.
The sticker looks bad?
The sealed one? Yeah, it does not look good to me.
The actual seal looks bad?
No, yeah, because no, the UPC sticker, it's too small. It's really cut down.
Uh-oh, you think it's fake?
It doesn't look like I can't say it's fake. I can say that does not look like any other sticker I have ever seen on this.
Well, you can compare it to the one I just sold if you hit completed.
No, I mean I have one. I mean I've seen a lot of these stickers and none of them looks like this. So
oh, I see. Yeah, I think I have one of my I think my Spider-Man one has one. And yeah, you think you're right. It covers the entire UPC on the actual case itself.
Yeah, exactly. Like this it's too small.
Interesting, Chris. This is why I don't like overvaluing this sort of stuff, because you never know.
Right.
With this.
Well, I mean, I know that mine is real.
Sure.
But this I would really want to. Is this also if this is like
is that sticker on the outside of the seal or on the inside? I can't tell from the picture. Either.
Yeah, but if it's on, but you know the thing is, if it's so they did shrink wrap these, but not in Europe, so. They would take the European release, put the sticker on it, and then shrink wrap over the whole thing. So the sticker wouldn't be on the outside. It would be on the inside. But then if this guy's going to fake this, he would have had to fake
the seal
as well.
Gotcha.
So I don't know.
We'll see,
I'm
Chris.
Not sure about this. Yeah.
We'll see about that. I'm satisfied with my European version. I'm cool because it's the same as
Oh, totally. Yeah, you really, you know, it's like you have to make this determination, like how much do you want to pay for a sticker?
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a good deal on mine, but.
So, Chris, what else you got going on in the future? You've been working on Kotaku for a short period of time.
Oh. I wrote the book Power Up that we talked about, but my most recent book is called Final Fantasy V. It's for a publisher called Boss Fight Books. The book itself is about the game Final Fantasy V, but it's additionally, in addition to being a sort of a deep dive on that game, it is about my kind of like life as a teenager getting into importing video games, because Final Fantasy V was the first game I ever actually imported because I got really impatient because it wasn't coming out in the US, so I had to buy the Japanese Super Famicom game. And it's about kind of like that era. And so it's really about the era of like, I bought this game, and then a year later, emulators started to appear, and then a year later, everybody in the U.S. could play Final Fantasy V because you could emulate it. And it's about like going from this era of scarcity, you know, U.S. Gamers learning more about Japan. It's about me going to Japan, and so it's like half. It's half like a story about that particular era of gaming culture, and then half like a super deep dive into the making of Final Fantasy V, all about Final Fantasy V, why Final Fantasy V is the best Final Fantasy. So if that at all interests you, you should check that out.
Check it out. It's on Amazon.
It is.
And Chris is still putting in work at Kotaku there. Mm-hmm. You know, you gotta tell Jason over there that NES games don't age as badly as he thinks they do.
Jason is he is younger than we are. And okay. You don't think it because he looks like an old man, but he's actually like he's not a generation behind me, but he's a video gaming system generation behind me. Uh-huh. And I think that like I start with NES, so I think that that's where the good games started, and then Atari, all the Atari people started with Atari, so they think that's where the good games started.
Gotcha.
And Jason is a Super Nintendo kid, so he believes that Super Nintendo is where all the good games started, and then everything prior to that is whatever. Pat, what's really going to mess you up is all this when people start saying that the Nintendo 64 was where all the good games started, and everything prior to that was no good.
No one's saying that, Chris, because I don't think people are getting behind the N64 that much, besides like
that's,
the 10 years.
That's real. No, it will happen, and it really will make you feel like an old man when they say when they say Super Mario 64 is the best Mario, and you know Mario World is clunky and old. Yeah,
talk about a console aesthetic that didn't stick around at all. I mean, that's really it. I mean, that sort of got lost in a puddle there. Nintendo sort of made a mass miscalculation with the N64 that they paid for, and you can argue are still paying for today. But hey, I offered to send Jason a free copy of my book. If you see him in the hallway or on a conference call, tell him that offer still stands. So Chris, where can people find you online and on Twitter?
Twitter, my handle is KobunHeat, KobunHeat, like a Kobun, the serve bot for Marvel vs. Capcom, and then the word heat, HEAT. I picked that handle because it was 2008, and I did not realize that like your Twitter handle would be like your one way of people to contact you for the rest of your life. So I made a Marvel vs. Capcom 2 joke when I signed up for Twitter, and I'm stuck with it, and I'm verified.
I'm Pat the NES Punk on Twitter. So
there you go. You're never going to be able to get away from that branding, that character. So yeah, that's me on Twitter. Yeah, that's how you can find me.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris, for spending some time with me. I'm hoping to haggle with you again vociferously at an upcoming convention. There's me showing.
Give me hell.
Give you hell.
Don't let me get away with anything.
You know I don't. Thanks a lot, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Pat.
That does it for this edition of the Not So Common podcast. Thanks again to Chris for speaking to me. Guys, check out sponsor Dollar Shave Club. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/Pat, and you can try the Executive Razor. It's a 6-blade razor with 4 cartridges for only $1 with free shipping. There's no commitment, and you can cancel anytime. It gives you a nice close shave, which I should probably do after this podcast. Again, check out Dollar Shave Club. They have lots of other articles for grooming for men. They have soaps. They have oils, they have shampoos, anything you could ever want for bathroom grooming. One wipe Charlie's if you use those. Again, go to dollarshaveclub.com/Pat and you try any razor there, including the Executive Razor, for only $1. $1 with free shipping. That's it for this edition of the Not So Common Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on YouTube if you're watching there, or on your podcast platform of choice if you listen. Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever you use to listen to your podcast. You can rate the podcast, click the thumbs up, you can leave a comment, and please, please spread the love on social media, Twitter, Facebook. Let others know how much you enjoy my ramblings. Finally, if you want to help support my ramblings and keep the lights on in this new studio, you can check out my Patreon. It's patreon.com/PatContry. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.